Story building Lonnie'd bought on Lower State Street was the original home of the Spring Fresh Ice Cream Company, which had operated from 1907 until it went into bankruptcy proceedings in 1931. The name Spring Fresh and the year 1907 were carved in Gothic-style lettering on the gray stone lintel above the entrance. For 24 years, the ground floor was occupied by the Spring Fresh Ice Cream Emporium, after which the space was taken over by a series of food-related businesses, a luncheonette, a candy store, a soda fountain, and a tea shop, while the two stories above it were let as offices. I learned all of this because a plaque mounted to the right of the front door sketched the building's metamorphosis, including its designation as a historical landmark. When I pushed through the glass doors into the lobby, I could see that the walls had been taken back to the bare brick. The city had doubtless required Lonnie to do some serious earthquake retrofitting, but the contemporary infrastructure, steel girders and supports, had been hidden in the walls. I suspected that the materials I was looking at, while old, had been rescued from a teardown elsewhere in town. The ceiling had been removed, and an atrium now extended from the ground floor to a lofty third-floor dome. Light poured in through the curved glass with brass ribs, which resembled a giant umbrella overhead. The second and third stories opened onto the atrium, ringed with circular wrought-iron balustrades. A continuous stretch of offices was visible on each floor. Below, the reception area was so large that it dwarfed the 60-inch glass table in the center with its collection of antique milk canisters and churns. Instead of art, the walls were hung with old black-and-white photographs of Santa Teresa in the early part of the century. Two gentlemen in bowler hats and three-piece suits posed in front of the building with a mule-drawn milk wagon at the curb. In the photo taken just after the 1926 earthquake, the buildings on either side had been reduced to rubble, while the Spring Fresh headquarters had escaped with only minor damage. The marble floor was white tile with a pattern of black insets, probably new but mimicking the original. I will swear to you that the air smelled like vanilla ice cream. I checked the directory and located the office number for Burke Benjamin, 201, which I assumed was on the second level. An ancient-looking cage elevator with polished brass doors was still in operation. I entered, slid the retractable metal gate shut, pressed the brass 2 button, and went up. My ascent was slow and curiously entertaining as the facing walls, just outside the cage, had been plastered with a collage of vintage Spring Fresh posters and circulars. When I stepped off the elevator on the second floor, the receptionist looked up and smiled pleasantly. She was a woman in her 50s, with unrepentantly gray hair and a gray sweater dress that looked hand-knit. Far from washing the color from her complexion, the overall palette generated a vibrant aura, which was both striking and soft. The name placard on the desk indicated that the receptionist was Hester Maddox.
"I'm Hester. You must be Kinsey."
"I am. Nice meeting you," I replied as we shook hands across her desk. Hester glanced at the old-fashioned wall clock.
"Miss Benjamin should be here shortly. Why don't you have a seat? Can I get you anything, water or coffee?"
"I'm fine, thanks." I settled on a camelback sofa upholstered in a caramel velvet that looked good enough to lick. On the small brass and glass coffee table in front of me, there were copies of Forbes magazine, the ABA Journal, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, 5 law-related publications, and 3 issues of People magazine, a guilty pleasure of mine. I skipped the issue devoted to Mike Tyson's latest difficulties and bypassed the lengthy coverage on caring for aging parents and the painful decisions attendant thereon. Given my orphan status, the problem wasn't one I'd have to face. Henry and his sibs might be octogenarians and nonagenarians, but they had always been self-sufficient, and if one of them suffered a medical malfunction, the others would rally with unfailing support. I picked up the October 10, 1988 issue and turned to the story about Jersey girl Patty Scialfa replacing actress Julianne Phillips
in Bruce Springsteen's heart. The article detailed the development of the romance, which surfaced a scant 3 years after Springsteen and Julianne Phillips were married. The story moved from Patti Scalfa's early career to her current state of bliss, and ended with gushings of the "they were clearly meant for each other" variety. Oh yeah, right, like that marriage would last. I heard the elevator doors open and looked up as a curly-haired adolescent boy emerged in bicycle shorts and running shoes. He had no helmet that I could see, and I wondered if his mother knew. His shirt was plastered to his back with sweat, and his blonde hair was a mass of dripping ringlets. As he passed, he glanced at me. "Are you Kinsey?" "That's right." "Burke Benjamin," she said. She wiped her right palm on her pants and then held it out. As soon as we shook hands, she moved on, saying, "Come with me." I set the magazine aside and followed. She held open her office door for me and then closed it behind me. "Have a seat. I'll be right with you." I chose one of her two leather-upholstered visitor's chairs, thinking she'd excuse herself and retire to the ladies' room to shower. Instead, she opened her bottom desk drawer and pulled out a dark red terry cloth bath towel. She kicked off her running shoes, peeled off her gym socks, and crossed her arms so she could pull her soggy T-shirt over her head. Shirt dispensed with, she peeled out of her bra and bike shorts. "Hester says you're a friend of Lonnie's." "I am," I said, eyes averted. She wore thong underpants. This is a sight that doesn't inspire confidence when consulting an attorney in the matter of $500,000. She was completely nonchalant as she toweled sweat from her neck and underarms. She wadded up the damp shirt and tossed it in her bottom desk drawer, simultaneously taking out a clean bra, which she hooked into place, followed by a white T-shirt that she slipped over her head. She removed a neat navy blue skirt from a hanger and zipped herself into it, then slipped on heels without hose. From another drawer, she pulled out a hairdryer that was apparently permanently plugged in. She bent from the waist and blew her hair dry with a protracted blast of hot air that riffled papers on her desk. By the time she returned the dryer to the drawer, she looked completely put together, and her manner was properly professional, including the ringlets, which offset her no-nonsense air. "What can I do for you?" "I find myself in a peculiar situation, and I need help." "Well, you came to the right place. What's up?" I removed Dace's will from my shoulder bag and passed it across the desk to her. The document was only 4 pages long. She took her time, leafing back and forth through the pages, until she grasped the whole of it. She placed the document on the desk in front of her. "Nice. I take it the two of you were close." "We're related, but I never met the man," I said. "Well, I guess that pretty much eliminates any claim by his 3 kids that you exercised undue influence over dear old Dad," she said. "What's the nature of your relationship?" "I'm guessing we're second cousins, though I haven't had that confirmed. I know my grandparents' names, but aside from that, I know nothing about my father's side of the family. This has come as a complete surprise." I gave her an abbreviated version of the story, which sounded just as preposterous in summary as it would have if I'd stopped to spell it out. I gave her a thumbnail account of his conviction for felony murder, and his subsequent exoneration, the $600,000 settlement, and his falling out with his kids. Fortunately, Burke Benjamin was smart, and she'd doubtless been exposed to stories just as bizarre. Toward the wrap-up, I said, "I don't know what happened when Dace last saw his kids. According to Dandy, who was one of the 3 witnesses to the will, Dace showed up at Ethan's door shortly after he got out of prison. He thought he could make amends, but he was stonewalled. So he got his back up and disinherited all 3 of them. That's what he told Dandy. Again, I don't know them, and I have no idea what the family dynamic was." "He was a Santa Teresa resident?" "As I understand it, yes. He lived in Bakersfield for years before he went to prison. After his aborted reunion with his kids, He headed to Santa Teresa in hopes of finding me. Apparently, he loved it here. He told Dandy this was it. He had no intention of living anywhere else. Homeless though he was, she said. Homeless though he was, I said back to her with a smile. Which would make the Santa Teresa courthouse the proper place of probate administration, she said. She picked up the will again and glanced at the last two pages. I see an address for Ethan Dace. What about the other two kids? I don't have contact numbers for them. I've been thinking I'd be smart to drive to Bakersfield to deliver the news in person. I'm hoping Ethan can put me in touch with Ellen and Anna. I'd put that item at the top of the list. You're required to give proper legal notice to the children. That's essential. They can be served by mail or by personal delivery with a notice of hearing. In fact, I'd send the full package, the notice and the petition for probate with all attachments, including the will. Even if I'm sole beneficiary? Especially if you're sole beneficiary. The will states he's deliberately omitting his three kids. But that's subject to challenge. The notice gives them the opportunity to attend the hearing and assert their rights, should they choose to do so. You'll also have to publish the notice of petition to administer estate in the Santa Teresa Dispatch. That's something you can mail to the legal publication department of the paper. Even though he states he has no debts, the notice of petition will advise any other interested parties that they can serve the representative of the estate with a written request of special notice when the inventory, appraisement, and petition for final distribution are filed. I held up a hand. You mentioned a hearing. Good point. Let me back up and talk you through this. Where's the body currently? The coroner's office. Have him move to a mortuary, and they'll provide you with 6 to 10 copies of the death certificate so you can wind up his affairs. You'll also have to notify the Social Security Administration, but that's not pressing at this point. You'll want to go over to the Superior Court and pick up a couple of forms, the first of which is a petition, which asks two things. To have the will entered into probate, and for a representative to be appointed. You, in this case, since that's what Dace specified in his will. The guy didn't do me any favors, I said. What else are we talking here? She shrugged. He says he has no other assets aside from the settlement money, but you'd be smart to verify that instead of taking his word for it. He might have community property interest in stocks or bonds or some other item of value he's forgotten about. I'm assuming that was all divvied up when he got his divorce. I know the house he owned in joint tenancy with his wife was quitclaimed over to her. Take a look at the divorce agreement. For all you know, the decree could require Dace to provide for his three children in his estate plan. Better yet, you might call his divorce attorney, who'd be a particularly good source of information. Income tax returns are another good place to look. Speaking of which, am I going to have to pay income taxes on this money? Nope. You're clear on that score. Federal estate exemption was raised to $600,000 just last year. That's one more reason to make sure he has no other assets that might boost the estate over the $600,000 threshold. California inheritance taxes were repealed in 1982 by voter initiative. Well, hallelujah. I'm not done yet, she said. You need to look for retirement accounts, IRAs and the like, and life insurance policies, though those proceeds, if any, would be paid to the beneficiaries identified in the policy itself. You think his kids will come after me? Are you kidding? Why wouldn't they? Not only did he disinherit them, but he left all his money to someone he never met. Plus, he was homeless in the last stage of his life, which suggests instability. Those kids have nothing to lose. There's no bequest to them, at least not as far as I can see, so any no-contest clause would be out the window. Then you have the witnesses. I said, oh, man, will they have to show up in court? I should warn you, the three aren't exemplary citizens. You know them? I do. They're currently residents of Harbor House, and at least one of them has an issue with alcohol. All we need are two witnesses anyway, which gives us a one drunk margin. The will is self-proving. When the witnesses signed, not only did they declare Dace was of sound mind and memory and not acting under duress, menace, fraud, or undue influence, but that the facts were true and correct under penalty of perjury. It helps that this was signed, sealed, and delivered, so to speak, before you were pulled into the equation. "This already sounds too complicated," I said. "Can't I hire you to take care of it?" "Absolutely. The clerical work isn't the issue here. Where you're going to need representation is in the event that these kids show up in court with a phalanx of attorneys. Now, that would be fun." She opened a desk drawer and took out two printed sheets stapled together in one corner. "Here's a couple of pages of instructions you can keep for ready reference. It's a lot to take in, and you've probably blanked out half of what I've said." I glanced at the pages she gave me, but all of it seemed to be gibberish. I must be having a mental breakdown. None of this makes sense. She stood and peered across the desk. "Oh, that's the Spanish version." She held out a hand and I returned the pages. She substituted the English language version, which I couldn't bring myself to read. "How soon will you be driving to Bakersfield?" she asked. "I'd like to go tomorrow morning. Why don't I meet you at the Superior Court Clerk's office at 8 o'clock? We can get this process underway, and then you can hit the road." "Great. That sounds good," I said. "Do I pay as we go, or will you bill me?" She waved the issue aside. "Don't worry about it. I'll bill you. You're a friend of Lonnie's, and that's good enough for me." Chapter 12. I did as Burke Benjamin had suggested, and stopped by the records department at the courthouse after I left her office. I paid the fee for the proper forms, which I would complete and return to the Superior Court Clerk's office next door, when I submitted the original of Dace's will. I went back to my office and scrutinized the petition as though studying for a test. The format was straightforward, providing a number of boxes that could be marked with X's or left blank according to the dictates of any given case. I flipped the page over and saw that there was another full set of questions on the back that I'd get to in due course. I rolled the first page into my typewriter and spent far more time than necessary making sure the paper was properly aligned. When faced with a tedious questionnaire, which is essentially what this was, the only remedy is to tackle the job one line at a time. In the top box, I typed in my name and address. I typed in Dace's full name, put an X in the box indicating the petition was for probate of will and for letters testamentary. I could see now that this was closer to a multiple-choice test where the answers had to be debated one by one to decide which seemed closest to the facts. I'd been taught to tackle the easy answers first and then go back to the tougher ones. I patiently X'd my way down the page until I reached the question about the estimated value of the estate. I wasn't sure what to say. I typed in the sum in Dace's savings account. Under real property, I typed none, which might or might not be correct. When I reached the bottom of the page, I scarcely had the heart to plow on, but I forced myself to persevere. I did pause at the line that read, "Proposed executor is named in the will and consents to act." I thought, really? Consents? I had a choice here. It hadn't occurred to me that I could abdicate my responsibilities as representative of the estate, but there was actually a box I could mark if I decided to refuse. The idea was tempting, but what justification could I supply? There were no boxes to be marked declaring that I was insane, incompetent, or stupid. I couldn't picture simply piping up in court, telling the probate judge I didn't feel like doing it, but thanks so much. That $500,000 was going to end up someplace, and I had to accept the fact that it was my job to escort it through the system. I completed the form, removed the document from the typewriter, made a copy, and then made 4 copies of Dace's will on my handy-dandy copy machine. I then put the paperwork in a manila envelope, which I slid into my shoulder bag. A copy of the inventory form and copies of the papers that had been in the safe deposit box I tucked into a file folder, which I'd be taking with me. I was already thinking ahead to the trip for which I'd have to allot 2 days. The drive was roughly 2.5 hours. If I took care of clerical matters first thing in the morning, I could probably leave by 9. Once in Bakersfield, I'd track down Ethan at the address his father had noted in the will, and hope he'd be willing to put me in touch with his sisters. I knew nothing of the family, but if Evelyn Dace still harbored hostile feelings about her ex, it would be smart to avoid her altogether. The provisions of the will wouldn't affect her in any event, and I was praying she'd keep her distance. I stowed my Smith Corona in the trunk and then drove home, taking my emotional temperature, which was only slightly elevated in anticipation of events to come. I was certain my anxiety could be soothed if Henry offered me a batch of cinnamon rolls or an 8x8 pan of chocolate chunk brownies. All in all, I felt good. I like having a mission. I like being on the move. The actual balance in Dace's bank account was funny money as far as I was concerned. I wasn't going to think about it until the details were sorted out. I parked, and I was making my way through the squeaky gate when I stopped in my tracks. Was I out of my tiny mind? The implications of the situation descended like a 100-pound weight. I had a brief vision of myself knocking on Ethan's door. "Hi, you don't know me, but I'm a very, very distant relative. Your father cut you out of his will and left everything to me." This was not going to go well. Dace's kids knew nothing of me, and I knew precious little about them. In one stroke, Dace had relieved them of a sizable inheritance and placed the burden on me. Why would they be pleasant or courteous or even civil when I was delivering such bad news? They'd be pissed as hell. Maybe notifying Ethan by mail was a better approach. If he or his sisters wanted to contest the terms of the will, he could contact me through his attorney. That would save me driving 150 miles to get the shit kicked out of me. I didn't want to deal with their rage or their indignation. If the three of them were indifferent to the news of their father's death, I didn't want to deal with that either. Dace had made a mess of his life, but he'd tried to make amends. Drink and drugs aside, he'd been dealt a bad hand. It was time for someone to give the poor guy a break. Just then, Henry came striding around the corner of the building with a bucket of water and a folded newspaper under one arm, narrowly avoiding bumping into me. I yelped as water sloshed out of the bucket and down the front of my all-purpose dress. I don't know which of us was more surprised. He put the bucket down. "Sorry, I'm so sorry, but I had no idea you'd be standing there." "Don't worry about it," I said. I'd thought to reassure him, but I must have telegraphed something of my upset and confusion, because his look changed from surprise to concern. He reached out and touched my arm. "What's the matter?" "Nothing. I'm fine. It's been a hell of a day." "You look like you lost your best friend." "Worse. It's much worse. I don't even know where to begin."
"I've got time."
"No, really. You're in the middle of something. I don't want to interrupt."
"Washing windows. I haven't even started yet. What's worse than losing a friend?"
"Someone left me $500,000, give or take," I added in the interest of being accurate.
"The bastard! That's terrible!"
He expected me to laugh, but all I could do was moan. There have been occasions when his kindness has caused me to burst into tears. I couldn't even manage that. He set the bucket and the newspaper on the walk and took me by the arm.
He steered me toward the back patio where he sat me down in an Adirondack chair. I propped my elbows on my knees and hung my head, wondering if I was going to throw up or faint. He grabbed a lightweight aluminum lawn chair and swung it over close to mine. What in the world is going on? I pressed my fingers against my eyes. You won't believe this. I don't believe it. I'm not sure I will either, but give it a try. Remember the guy in the morgue with my name in his pocket? Of course, the one who died on the beach. Turns out, we're related. Probably by way of my grandmother, Dace. He came here in hopes of finding a distant family member, and it turns out I'm it. Not only that, but he was on the fritz with his kids, so he left all his money to me, which means I'll have to drive to Bakersfield and spring the news on them. $500,000, and I'd never even met the man. Where'd he get the money? You said he was homeless. Homeless, but not broke. Big difference. He spent 12 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Once he was exonerated, he sued the state. For $500,000? For $12 million. The settlement was $600,000. After a few minor withdrawals, there's $595,350 left. No strings attached? Are you kidding me? It's all strings. He also named me executor of the estate, so I now gotta jump through legal hoops. And what am I supposed to do about a funeral? The guy has to have a decent burial. What if his kids won't step up to the plate? I'll have to take care of that on top of everything else. I don't get it. How did I end up babysitting a dead guy? He slapped his knees decisively and got up. I have the solution. You come with me. This calls for a pan of brownies. And that's when I burst into tears. As soon as the brownies were cool enough, I ate half the pan and then stayed through supper. Henry plied me with comfort foods, homemade chicken noodle soup and homemade dinner rolls slathered with butter and strawberry jam. Weeping deadens your sense of taste and smell, so I had to suck it up and compose myself. For dessert, as a reward for cleaning my plate, I had 2 more brownies, which left him with 2. Through the meal, we argued about my trip to Bakersfield, which I was now thoroughly opposed to. It felt good to focus on a plan over which I had some control. Henry thought my original instinct was correct. Dace's children are probably already feeling put upon and betrayed, he said. What good could possibly come of their learning about his death through a notice in the paper or a letter in the mail? Better than hearing it from me, I said. How am I going to explain they've been disinherited? If I show up on Ethan's doorstep with that news, he'll think I'm there to gloat. You'll do fine. You're articulate. Open a dialogue. Tell them how you got caught up in this. You know about the last few months of Terence Dace's life. His children should have the information. I don't know anything about the last few months of his life. I'm only going on what I've been told. Matters not. You said Dace made a point about the executor of his will delivering the news. I was shaking my head in despair. I can't do it. Truly. They're bound to react badly. It's like begging to be abused. First they find out he died, and then they find out he screwed him over in death the way he screwed him in life. You don't know that for a fact. What, that he screwed them over in life? Look at it from their perspective. God knows what they went through during his arrest, trial, and sentencing. They must have been mortified. After that, Mom divorces him and he goes to prison, presumably for life. He put them through the ringer. But he didn't commit a crime. He was falsely accused. The legal system was at fault. The judge, the lawyers, and police made a terrible mistake. You'd think his kids would be thrilled to find out he was telling the truth. Not so. From what Dandy tells me, the visit was a bust.
Do you think he told his kids how much money he had?
Beats me. Dandy and Pearl suspected he had money, but apparently he never revealed how much. I don't want to be the one who drops that bomb on them. Once the kids find out I'm sole beneficiary, no telling what they'll do. Henry shook his head.
You're just trying to save your own skin.
Of course I am. Wouldn't you do the same?
That's neither here nor there. Tell them what happened. Lay the whole story out the same way you told me. It's not your fault they severed the relationship. It's not your fault he named you in his will.
You think they'll take such a charitable view?
Well, no, not likely. But it's better if you take the high road and handle this one-on-one.
I put my head down on the table and groaned.
Kinsey, the money isn't theirs. It was never theirs. Their father had the right to do anything he wanted with it.
What if they feel entitled to it? They're his natural heirs. Why wouldn't they feel they had a right to it?
In that case, it becomes a legal issue, and they'll have to hire an attorney.
I thought about it briefly. I guess if they raise a huge stink, I could offer to divide the money among the three of them.
In no way, absolutely not. If he'd wanted them to have the money, he'd have set it up that way. He named you executor because he trusted you to carry out his wishes, which are plainly stated.
I reached out and grabbed his arm.
I just had a great idea. You can come with me. You're good at things like this.
You're diplomatic, and I'm not. I'll make a botch of it. If you're with me, I'll have an ally.
Nope. No can do. I've got William to contend with. Someone has to get him to his physical therapy appointments.
He can take a cab. He's already said he would.
You're forgetting Ed. I can't very well go off and leave the little guy. We're in the bonding process.
He'd feel betrayed.
You think a cat can feel betrayed?
Of course. Why would he not?
He might not understand the concept as such, but he'd certainly be crushed if I abandoned him after finally winning his trust.
William could look after him, couldn't he? He's just as much a part of Ed's life as you are.
He most certainly is not.
Well, nearly. I mean, Ed knows William. It's not like you'd be leaving a stranger in charge.
Why don't you look at it another way?
There's a big chunk of your history buried in Bakersfield. You're actually related to these people. I'm not sure how, but that's a question worth pursuing. Think of yourself as a diplomat. You're a delegate from your branch of the family, reaching out to theirs. I grant you the introductions might be awkward, but as long as you're going, you can fill in some gaps in your family tree. Actually, Dace did you a good turn. This is a rare opportunity, a chance to integrate. Forget the emotional content and play it straight.
I stared at the floor. I wish I had your confidence.
You'll be fine.
I left Henry's at 9 o'clock that night and made a quick trip to the nearest service station to put gas in the car. On the way home, I stopped by the bank and pulled cash from an ATM. I was in bed by 10. I didn't sleep well, but then I didn't expect to sleep well. I woke at 2:30 and again at 4. The next time I opened my eyes, it was 5:15, and I decided to call it quits. I got up, made the bed, and pulled on my sweats. I started a load of laundry and left it to churn while I did my 3-mile jog. The run was the last thing in the world I wanted to do, but I knew it was the right stress-busting move. When I returned 30 minutes later, I shifted the damp clothes into the dryer and then took my shower. By the time I'd dressed and eaten my cereal, I was feeling better. Talking through the problem with Henry had helped me put it in perspective.
I was making things too complicated. The trip to Bakersfield was a necessary element in my responsibilities as executor of Dace's estate. It was a mistake to overthink the task. I had no clue what kind of reception I'd get. The best tack was to go with an open heart and deal with whatever came to pass. Looking back, I can't believe I was able to say this to myself with a straight face. My clothes were still warm from the dryer as I packed my duffel. I was eager to hit the road, but I had matters to tend to first. When the Santa Teresa County Clerk Recorder's office opened at 8 o'clock, Burke Benjamin and I were the only two people in line. I presented myself, paperwork in hand, paid the fees, filed the petition for probate, and submitted the original of Dace's will. I could have strung out the process, waiting to file until I returned from Bakersfield, but I knew I'd reached the point of no return, and I liked the sense that forward motion was inevitable. The clerk assigned a case number and gave me a court date that fell in the middle of December, which meant I had ample time to take care of the busy work. Burke made sure I had certified copies of all the necessary documents. At her suggestion, I picked up forms to fill out for the notice I'd need to have published in the Santa Teresa Dispatch. Burke said she'd cover anything that came up in my absence. I made a quick stop at the office to pick up the mail that had come in the day before. I sat down at my desk and took care of a detail or two. Mostly, I tidied up so if I ran off the road and died, my survivors would think my desk was always neat. At 9 o'clock, I put in a call to Mr. Sherrinson at Winnington Blake Mortuary, asking him to retrieve R.T. Dace's body from the coroner's office and move him to the funeral home. I could tell Mr. Sherrinson was on the verge of rolling out condolences, but I pretended I had another call coming in on my one-line phone, and thus made short work of it. Before I hit the road, I stopped at the house to let Henry know I was on my way. He was out somewhere, but he'd left a hinged wicker picnic basket on my doorstep. I lifted the flap and saw that he'd packed me a sandwich, an apple, some potato chips, and 6 chocolate chip cookies. He'd also tucked in a map of Bakersfield. Ed, the cat, had contributed a parting gift as well. He'd caught and killed a mole, graciously leaving me the head, which he'd licked clean of fur right down to the bone. I was on the road by 9:30. The die, as they say, was cast. Chapter 13. Pete Walensky, June 1988, 4 months earlier. Friday morning, June 17th, a lengthy typewritten report arrived in the mail postmarked Reno, Nevada. The report itself was dated June 15th, 1988, and covered the surveillance on Mary Lee Bryce during her stay at the Conference Hotel over the Memorial Day weekend. The bill attached was for $3,000 plus change. The cash expenditures and credit card charges were neatly itemized with all the relevant receipts attached. Pete ran the total himself and found it to be correct. The PI hadn't fudged by a penny, which Pete found hard to believe. Pete hadn't wanted to do the legwork himself because he didn't have the money to fly to Reno. He'd canceled the second set of round-trip plane tickets he'd paid for, though he realized he'd forgotten to turn them in for his refund, which the travel agent assured him would be forthcoming. He had no intention of shelling out any of the $2,500 Willard had paid. Once the cash was safely tucked away, Pete contacted Con Dolan, now retired from the STPD and always up for a chat. He mentioned needing to sub out a job, and Dolan had said he'd get back to him with a contact name shortly. Once Dolan passed along the contact numbers, Pete made the call and laid out his problem. While the fellow didn't seem wild about the work, he agreed to do it, quoting what Pete considered an exorbitant fee. Pete asked the PI to include an invoice when the work was done, and he submitted his report. As this was a matter between two professionals, a verbal agreement was sufficient.
Pete laid the report on his desk, pressing the pages flat, and then leaned close enough for the typeface to come into focus. His eyesight was getting worse. The last time he'd seen an optometrist, he was told he might be helped by corrective surgery, but the procedure sounded risky to him, and the expense made the option unlikely. He followed the lines of print with his finger so he wouldn't lose his place. The report came as a surprise. There was no indication whatever that Mary Lee Bryce was spending time with Dr. Linton Reed for romantic purposes or any other kind. Apparently, they attended most of the same symposia and were both present for many of the papers being presented. She was in the audience for the one given by Dr. Reed, but she didn't appear to hang on his every word. The two never sat together and barely even spoke. They shared no meals, didn't meet for drinks, and their rooms were not only on different floors, but at opposite ends of the hotel. When their paths did cross, they maintained the appearance of civility, but that was about it. The Nevada PI had even snapped photos in which Mary Lee Bryce and Dr. Reed were both in the same frame, their body language attesting to their mutual disinterest, if not mutual disdain. This didn't constitute proof of any kind, but it was telling. What surfaced instead was the fact that Mary Lee Bryce met twice with a reporter named Owen Penske, who worked for the Reno Gazette Journal. She and Penske had met in the hotel bar Thursday night, heads bent together briefly over drinks. The second assignation was a late supper on Sunday after the official conference sessions were wrapped up for the day. The two were apparently engaged in a lively discussion, and while there were no displays of affection, their interest in each other was clear. Pete studied the series of black-and-white photographs of the two, candid shots that were surprisingly clear given the use of a telephoto lens, which often distorted images or rendered them grainy. Even more titillating were the additional documents attached. Secondary sources revealed that Mary Lee Bryce, whose maiden name was Jacobs, was a classmate of Penske's at Reno High School, the two having graduated in the class of 1973. Included with the written report were photocopies of the relevant pages of the yearbook, showing the two at various school activities. Mary Lee Jacobs and Owen Penske were both members of the debate team, and both worked for the school paper, which was called the Red and Blue. While it wasn't clear that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, they had many interests in common. How many times had Pete heard tales of high school classmates reconnecting at reunions years after having parted company? Nothing more potent than old fantasies suddenly given new life. The Nevada investigator had done some extracurricular digging into Penske's background and turned up newspaper accounts of a scandal of major proportions. 2 years before, Owen Penske had been working for the New York Times as a feature writer. He'd already made quite a reputation for himself when he was accused of lifting passages from the work of another journalist. The charge of plagiarism gave rise to an investigation that uncovered evidence that Penske was also guilty of inventing sources for certain features he'd published. Every article he'd ever written became suspect. He'd been fired, and he'd left New York in disgrace. After 10 months scrambling for employment, he'd finally managed to pick up work at one of the Reno papers, a low point for a fellow who'd been everybody's darling such a short time before. Pete sat back and thought about this unexpected turn of events, wondering what to make of it. It wasn't necessarily the case that Mary Lee Bryce and Owen Penske were having an affair. Maybe this was just a matter of two old friends catching up, while the one was in town for professional reasons. Whatever the truth, there had to be a way to play it for maximum effect. The first move would be to spread the facts over more than one document. No point in turning over everything at once. It would be a kindness to let Willard digest the discovery by degrees. Pete went through the photographs and selected two from the Reno High School yearbook, the Re-Wa-Nee. As a senior, Mary Lee Jacobs was petite,
a redhead with pale brows and an expression that suggested perpetual anxiety. Owen Penske looked like the typical high school dork. Black-rimmed glasses, bad haircut, his neck barely big enough to hold up his head. In some ways, Mary Lee Brice and Owen Penske seemed well-suited for each other, since both projected insecurity. Pete himself had been an outcast in his teen years, so he didn't fault either one in that regard. He couldn't help but wonder if Penske was dishonest by nature, or if he'd taken up cheating to compensate for a lack of self-confidence. Odd that Mary Lee had ended up married to a man whose coloring was so much like her own. She and Willard were close enough in appearance to be brother and sister instead of husband and wife. Pete wondered how Willard's unfortunate accident had factored into the overall equation. The wreck that killed his best friend and resulted in the loss of his own leg dated back to his youth, which meant he was already on crutches when he and Mary Lee first met. Some women were drawn to the physically impaired, witness his own wife's attraction to him. He swiveled his chair and scooted closer to a rolling typewriter table and removed the cover from his manual Remington Streamliner. He'd bought the machine in 1950, and aside from a few minor repairs, it had served him handily ever since. He opened his desk drawer and removed two sheets of stationery and placed a carbon between them, then rolled them into the carriage and began the laborious job of retyping the report on his own letterhead. He made minor adjustments so the language would sound more like his own. Despite his two-fingered typing technique, he was fast and accurate. Even so, the job took him the better part of an hour. The Nevada investigator was very detail-oriented, and he spared nothing in his passion for spelling out the minutiae. This allowed Pete to pick and choose his facts while he converted the report to his own personal style. By judicious editing, he could easily fashion a follow-up report and charge for that as well. The relationship between Mary Lee Brice and this Penske fellow certainly cried out for further study. If he could talk Willard into extending their agreement, he could submit a second round of paperwork without actually having to do anything. The report itself offered no interpretation or speculation about the nature of the relationship. Pete liked the neutral tone, which seemed crisp and professional, one he might have adopted himself if he'd elected to do the work. He'd offer Willard a verbal summary first in which he'd set the stage. Properly prepared, Willard would be eager to authorize additional surveillance. Pete took the finished report, made a copy for his files, and attached the photocopies of both sets of round-trip tickets with the relevant adjustments made to reflect how thoroughly he'd done his work. The Nevada PI had spent four nights at the same convention hotel where Mary Lee Brice had been. Pete made a copy of the bill, whited out the other fellow's name and credit card information, typed his own into the blank, and photocopied the bill for a second time. He leaned close to the page, inspecting the results, and decided it would be fine and dandy for his purposes. Willard would be too busy hyperventilating over the contents to pay attention to expenses. Generously, Pete discounted his fees by 20%, which he noted at the bottom of the page. He tucked the paperwork in the half-filled banker's box and shoved it in the knee hole under his desk. He put a call through to Willard. Pete had scarcely identified himself when Willard jumped on him with both feet. "You want to tell me what's going on?" he'd snapped. "I should have heard from you weeks ago. As much money as I paid, I expected you to be prompt." "Now, let's just hold on a minute, son. I'm not some pal of yours doing you a personal favor. You hired me to do a job, and I went far above and beyond. Your tone is a hair accusatory for a man who'll benefit mightily from my being such a thoroughgoing professional. Most investigators would be content to leave well enough alone. I went the extra mile. Let's not even talk about the 20% discount I accorded you in appreciation for your business.
I guess none of what I uncovered is of interest.
He could picture Willard's eyelids turning a brighter shade of pink. Willard probably wasn't accustomed to being backed into a corner, and it took him a few seconds to collect himself.
I didn't say I wasn't interested, he murmured. You sounded pretty hot under the collar if you want my take on it.
I'm sorry. I've been a wreck waiting to hear from you. That's all I was trying to say.
You like, I can drop my report in the mail to you without further ado. You might find it more instructive if I go over it in person, but that's entirely your choice.
Instructive? Meaning what?
There's reality, and then there's facts. I'm saying there's a difference that I'd be happy to clarify. I should point out you could have called me at any point during these past 2 weeks, and I'd have told you the same thing. I had the information in hand. What's taken the additional time is the verification, supplied by an out-of-state colleague, purely as a courtesy to me. Do you want to take a look at it or not?
Of course. I'm sorry if I spoke out of turn. Mary Lee came home jumpier than I've ever seen her. I tried talking to her, but she shut me down. I have no idea what's going on.
The good news is I'm now in a position to fill in some blanks. I won't say my report's definitive, but it's a start. I can stop by later this afternoon.
That won't work. She's been leaving the lab early, practically barricading herself in the bedroom to make phone calls. You'd have to be here by 3, and you can't stay long.
Might make more sense if we conduct our business off-site. Why don't I pick you up and we'll go somewhere else?
What if she comes home while I'm out?
Leave her a note. Tell her you're having coffee with a friend, and don't specify the gender. Want my opinion? You'd benefit from creating an air of mystery around yourself. She's doubtless taking you for granted, and that won't help your cause.
Pete picked up Willard at the pre-arranged spot, a block and a half from the Bryce's apartment. He liked the cloak-and-dagger aspects of the meeting. He'd wanted to put Willard in the proper frame of mind, talking him through the findings before he surrendered the written account. Willard was having none of it, already impatient at having had to wait this long. He held out his hand, snapping his fingers twice as though Pete were a dog. Pete had no choice but to pass him the manila envelope. He drove south on the 101 while Willard removed the report and read it. Pete was uncomfortably aware of Willard's mounting distress. He took the off-ramp at the bird refuge, where he pulled into the abbreviated parking strip 25 feet from the water's edge. As a goodwill gesture, he'd picked up a bag of assorted donuts and 2 oversized cups of coffee he hoped would pacify Willard's angst. He experienced a twinge of guilt when Willard saw the photographs, almost as though he'd betrayed the man himself. Once Pete shut down the engine, they sat in the car. Pete was quiet, looking out at the saltwater lagoon where a passel of ducks squatted on the muddy shore. Certain times of the year, the lagoon threw off an aroma of rotten eggs. Pete didn't know how any of the nearby businesses could survive. Across from the parking lot, there was a restaurant, an athletic facility, and a bar called Cece's, the Caliente Cafe, where the off-duty cops hung out. Today, the odor wasn't too bad. The lagoon smelled faintly dank, with a secondary aroma of soggy vegetation and bird doo-doo. Willard held the papers loosely in his lap.
This is embarrassing. I wouldn't take that attitude. At least you know your instincts were good. Only difference is Dr. Reed's not the one you should be worried about.
From the information I managed to dig up, this is a former high school classmate, fellow named Owen Penske.
Willard's expression was a curious mix of perplexity and gloom. Pete said,
I don't mean to suggest a course of action. That's your decision. I will say, if it was me, I'd push this.
Right now, you really don't know what's going on.
Why is she even talking to the guy? I don't understand.
That's because you don't have all the information. If I might make a recommendation, your next move would be to put a tap on the line.
Are you talking about tapping our home phone?
Well, if she's calling him on her work phone, that's a tricky proposition. I'm not sure how I'd get into the lab to put a bug on that line. Simpler and more sensible to monitor her calls from home. That might tell us where to go next.
I don't like it.
I understand, Pete said. The connection with this Penske fellow may be entirely innocent. High school buddy lives in Reno?
No big deal.
She knows she'll be in town for this conference, so she sets up a meeting to say howdy and catch up on old times. I suspect there might be something more, but we're not going to know unless I'm authorized to act.
Shit!
No need to assume the worst. There's probably more to it than meets the eye, but from what I observed, I don't believe it's anything of a romantic nature.
What is it, then?
Willard sorted through the pages a second time, and then studied the copies of the black-and-white photos from the high school yearbook. His complexion, ruddy by nature, now looked like he'd spent too much time under a heat lamp.
I wouldn't want to speculate. She ever mentioned this Penske fellow?
No.
She might have looked him up when she got to Reno, on the off chance he was still in town. Old high school chum, a classmate. Nothing wrong with that.
But look how intense they are.
Fellow might have marital issues. Had you thought of that? She calls him to say hi, letting him know she's in town. He might have jumped at the idea of having a confidant.
Is he married?
Records check is next on my list if you decide to proceed. I didn't have a chance to go over to the Washoe County courthouse while I was there. Enough going on at the hotel that I felt my time was better spent on the premises.
What am I supposed to do now?
Up to you, Pete said. Phone calls in the bedroom with the door shut? I don't like the sound of that.
He paused to shake his head.
Easiest solution is to install a bug.
Stop saying that. I don't like spying on her. It's not right.
It's a little late to fret when you have a guy like me chasing all the way to Reno to take photographs. What's the point of stopping short when it might all be easily explained?
Willard sank into a brooding silence. Pete had to suppress his impatience. Here he was, spoon-feeding the fellow, coaxing him toward the obvious conclusion. Nothing as persuasive as a self-generated decision, even if it was Pete nudging him in the right direction.
Let Willard think he'd come up with it on his own.
Pete grew uneasy, wondering if he'd pushed the man too hard.
Believe me, I understand where you're coming from. You love your wife, so it's natural to want to maintain trust. At the same time, I can think of other explanations for what seems troublesome.
Such as what?
Suppose he had personal problems. Might have had a setback of some kind in his career. Fellow's a journalist, so it might be worthwhile to check that out.
What's involved in a phone bug? I mean, assuming I agree.
Simple matter of installing a device in the handset before she gets home. I can put a voice-activated tape recorder on remote. Close by, but not actually in the apartment. You don't want her to come across a piece of hardware while she's cleaning house. I can also plant a pen mic. Looks like a ballpoint pen, but it's capable of transmitting sound for short distances.
What will that accomplish?
Remains to be seen. My suggestion is we run audio a few days and see what we pick up. This whole business might not have anything to do with you.
Willard turned and stared out of the car window.
Okay.
Good man, Pete said.
He continued to sit in silence. Willard looked over at him.
So, is that it? There's the matter of another advance. Soon as I have that in hand, I'll go to work. Any more contact between the two, and I'll head back to Reno and do deep background on him.
Which is how Pete ended up 2 days later in Colgate, wearing a coverall while pretending to weed the flower border under Willard's bedroom window. He avoided yard work as a rule. Here it wasn't unpleasant, but it seemed undignified to be crawling around the building on his hands and knees. This was the second late afternoon he'd weeded. Day one had produced nothing. He'd started his labors in the central courtyard, uncertain where he'd pick up the best reception. Several residents had noticed him and nodded in acknowledgement, though none had stopped to chat. They seemed pleased that someone was actually being paid to tidy up. In addition to the phone bug, he'd supplied Willard with a pen mic and suggested he place it in the bedroom, preferably on the floor near the bedside table where the phone sat. There was an off chance Mary Lee might notice it, but if she was intent on shenanigans, she probably wouldn't be that observant. Day two, Pete picked up a most enlightening fragment of conversation. Mary Lee was home by 4. Pete had advised Willard to run an errand, giving her the opportunity to make a call, which is exactly what she did. Pete heard a lilting melody of numbers being punched, long distance, judging by the length. Sure enough, when a fellow on the other end picked up, all she said was, "It's me. I don't have much time, so let's make this quick. What's happening on your end?"
"Nothing. I told you my hands are tied." "What about the charts? Did you find them?"
"Not yet. I know where they are. I just can't get to them. I'm trying to track the one guy down, but it's tough. Can't you use the information I already gave you?"
She said something else Pete missed. He pressed a hand against his earphone. Penske's response was muffled. "Here says one could be a fluke. You need a pattern."
"Owen, I know that. How do you think I spotted it in the first place? The pattern's there. What I don't have is proof. Meantime, I'm walking on eggshells."
Something Pete missed. "You think Linton suspects?" Penske asked.
"I hope not. You don't understand how ruthless he is. It's fine as long as I'm in the lab, but I can't get anywhere near the clinic."
"Why not?"
"The lab's in Southwick Hall. The clinic's in the Health Sciences building."
"Why are the charts kept there?"
"Because that's where the subjects are seen for a follow-up."
"You can't just go over and ask?"
"Oh, right. Talk about a red flag," she said.
"You gotta give me something or I can't help. I told you that to begin with."
Exasperated, she said, "Shit. I'll think about it. Maybe I can come up with some excuse."
"Listen, I went back over my notes last night and came across that business about the paper you wrote. Plagiarism's serious damn business. Look what happened to me."
"I figured you'd appreciate the finer points," she said dryly.
"So you can't use that?"
"To do what? The journal was published in Germany. I wouldn't have known about it myself if someone hadn't sent it to me."
"That was a happy coincidence."
"Not at all. The friend who saw the article knew the subject was close to what I was working on at the time. He had no idea Linton lifted it from me. The department chair sure didn't want to hear my side of it. Linton was teacher's pet and could do no wrong."
"Too bad."
"Too bad is right. What he's doing here is worse. With the grant he got, he can't afford to fail."
"He's covered his butt by now, don't you think?"
"Nuh-uh. He has no clue I'm on to him. Otherwise, he'd have found a way to get rid of me before now. I mentioned his ripping me off because it's indicative of his..."
Pete missed the word. Distracted, he looked up and caught sight of Willard returning to the apartment. How long had he been gone? 15 minutes, tops. Not long enough to accomplish anything. Willard gave him the high sign, but Pete was too busy listening to respond.
"Hey, I understand. I'm just tapping on the wall to see if I can find a way in. What about his computer?"
I have his password, but that's it so far.
His password? Good girl. How'd you find it?
It was written on a piece of paper in his desk drawer.
How's that for clever?
But if you haven't actually gone into his database, what makes you so sure he's cooking?
Because I saw the printout before he shredded it.
What's that other term you used?
Dry labbing it. Don't get sidetracked, she said.
Pete missed Penske's response. He pressed his hand against the earbud and closed his eyes as though that might improve his hearing. Had he used the word trial? Must be clinical trials if they were talking about medical charts.
Listen, Owen, I'm working 10-hour days. I don't have a lot of time to play Sherlock Holmes. I can only do so much.
What about the incident at Arkansas?
No good. Hearsay. The girl who told me says he skirted disaster by going away for a much-needed rest. After that, he disappeared and reappeared somewhere else. She talked to Dr. Stupak twice. But he wouldn't pursue the matter for fear it would negatively impact his career.
Stupak's career?
Not Stupak's. Litton's. These guys are always circling the wagons. Any hint of trouble, they close ranks. Shit. Gotta go. Bye.
The line went dead, though he was still tuned into her end by way of the pen mic. Pete heard a door open and a muffled exchange. Mary Lee said,
"Wrong number."
A few seconds later, the door shut, and there was silence. She and Willard must have moved into the living room. What he'd been listening to wasn't romance. It appeared Mary Lee and this fellow were in cahoots. But what was the object of the exercise? Linton Reed, obviously. But in what context? Pete swapped out the tapes, inserting a blank on the off chance another call might transpire while he was gone. Once he was back at his desk, he put the recording into his player and listened to it twice. At first, he was annoyed he couldn't make heads nor tails of it. Clearly, Mary Lee Bryce and Owen Penske were trying to get the goods on Linton Reed, and if Pete hoped to profit, he needed to know what he was talking about. Faulty information was useless. Glucotase was the word he'd missed. He deciphered it on the third go-round and figured it must be a medical condition, maybe a test of some kind. There had also been mention of cooking numbers, which must be what it sounded like. You cook numbers, you're slanting the results. That's why Litton's getting the big grant put so much at stake. He worried the subject, turning it this way and that. As far as he could tell, there was only one interpretation. Linton Reed had been falsifying data. He wasn't sure how Mary Lee picked up on it, but she'd known him in the past, and apparently she'd been an early victim of his shady manipulations. At 5 o'clock, he gave up, locked the office, and headed for home. He was just pulling into his garage when he had a flash. He'd been thinking he couldn't move forward until he filled in the blanks. And how was he to do that when he didn't have a clue? What occurred to him was that all he had to do was go over to the medical library at St. Terry's and have somebody look it up. Linton Reed was vulnerable. Pete had no idea how, but he knew Owen Penske and Mary Lee Bryce were closing in on him. Judging from their phone chat, the good Dr. Reed hadn't quite caught on yet. Pete would be doing him a personal service by alerting him to the danger. There might even be a way